Charlie, what you've done is incredible here.
Maybe Charlie Kirk is on the college campus.
I want you to know we are lucky to have Charlie Kirk.
Charlie Kirk's running the White House, folks.
I want to thank Charlie. He's an incredible guy. His spirit, his love of this country. He's done an amazing job building one of the most powerful youth organizations ever created, Turning Point USA.
We will not embrace the ideas that have destroyed countries, destroyed lives, and we are going to fight for freedom on campuses across the country. That's why we are here.
Look, it's Christmas season. A lot of you guys are emailing us, freedom@charliekirk.com. How do I give back this Christmas season? Look, I know it's been a tough year, but those of us that are Christians, we are called to help and to assist regardless of the circumstances around us. Whether we had a blessed year or a tough year, it's time to step up and do something. I think we all know that. That's why we are partnering with AngelTree. AngelTree is great. They help kids whose parents are in prison. It's not even about the fact of what their parents did. It's the fact that the kids are alone. And the kids, if they do not hear from their parents, they're more likely to also get involved in crime in the future. So let's really communicate the love of Jesus Christ with a personalized note from their dad and an access to a Bible in either Spanish or English. And that's what the Fellowship Angel Tree program does. Last year, the Angel Tree program blessed over 300,000 children of prisoners all across America. What's so cool is that if you give directly, it doesn't go to overhead or all that stuff. It goes straight to the kid, especially this Christmas season. And so let's just keep it easy. Just go to charliekirk.com. There's a banner on the top of it, charliekirk.com, and we are getting behind it. We're donating a little bit of money from the Charlie Kirk Show to Angel Tree because we really believe in what they're doing. There's an Angel Tree banner there on charliekirk.com. You guys can check it out and support what we are doing. And I think that's really important because for a gift of $220, you can bless 10 children of prisoners with a personalized Christmas present and a personal note from their incarcerated parent. Plus, every Angel Tree family is also given access to free, easy to read copy of the Bible in English or Spanish. So check it out at charliekirk.com. Very, very important. Thank you guys so much for that. Thank you for having me. Honored to be here. There's a lot happening in the country. I first want to say thank you to Rita LeBlanc, one of our most generous and amazing friends in the country, to the Trout family, amazingly supportive of everything we do at Turning Point USA, the Deasons. Jackie Deason is an American hero. You really are. I was watching one of the live streams that certain networks have not been airing, and I heard a voice that was very familiar of that very now, I think we could call it infamous, video where all of a sudden they put these ballots under a table and then Jackie can describe it a lot better than I can as she was. And I said, that sounds like Jackie Deason. And so then I texted Doug. I said, is Jackie in Georgia right now testifying in front of the Georgia legislature? And it turns out that's correct. You've been doing amazing work in the election fight. And so many friends are here. Yes. And so I will, unlike some other kind of, let's just say, people out there that have decided to stop talking about what is obviously the most important thing on everyone's mind, which is what exactly happened in early November, I will dive right into that and help unpack that. And then we'll kind of talk about, I think, some broader themes. I do want to talk a little bit about young people and where we're headed in our country, and I'll talk until they kick me off, and, you know, we'll do that. So what happened in early November is probably the biggest fraud ever done, at least in my lifetime, at least in the last 100 years when it comes to elections. What happened in early November, and they told us exactly what they were going to do. They called it the Red Mirage. Things were going to look good on election night, and then all of a sudden, all these extra ballots would start to flow in, and things would normalize in their direction. So let's just start with what all of you are continuously bombarded with from all of your friends and sometimes family members, where they say there's no evidence of widespread voter fraud. So first of all, that is an incredibly foolish sentence to ever even tolerate. Who said anything about widespread? All it takes is 1% to win Georgia. It takes 0.5% to win Arizona. So what would he talk about? Widespread, it probably actually exists. All it takes is 15,000 ballots to not be correctly monitored with signatures. Mind you, they're very clever with how they do their words, the left. You have to give them credit. Because as they're talking about it, they say there's no, which is an objective statement, and then widespread, which is an incredibly subjective statements. How do you define subjective mathematically? How about this? They never say there's no evidence of consequential voter fraud. I've never heard them say that, because there is. There is evidence of consequential voter fraud. And voter fraud happens in a variety of different ways. And you guys know this in Dallas County. We were just catching up with your wonderful Dallas County chair. It happens in a variety of different ways. The first of which is the way that is the hardest to uncover, which is voter registration fraud, which is who's registering to vote. Are people on the voter rolls that shouldn't be there? People that move out of county, move out of state, they pass away. People that should not be registered to vote. Who actually cleans the voter rolls? Now, typically, that's the job of a Secretary of State. Typically, people who are in the Secretary of State position, they want to then eventually pursue a future political office. They're risk-averse people. They're not people that want to dive in and be called all these awful names to go purge the voter rolls. And this is particularly true in Pennsylvania and in Georgia, Arizona, Michigan, and Wisconsin. And so the amount, and you guys saw this when Robert Francis O'Rourke ran for the Senate in 2018, how many people that shouldn't have been registered to vote were registered to vote. I remember I visited University of Texas Austin, never doing that again without armed security. My goodness, what a cesspool of, by the way, A&M's not that much better, so we can go through all of that. But I think I've offended everyone in the room, unless someone went to SMU. I got plenty of time for that too, by the way. So anyway, so I went to UT Austin back in 18. Stacy was there with me, and of course, just the most, I say this, and I've said it before, there's some wonderful people that go to UT, there's some wonderful people that teach at UT, of course there is, right? And however, it is the, without a doubt, the most aggressively liberal school in the entire country. It's that simple, from my personal experience. And there's videos that have gone unbelievably viral, I could show you them, where they had signs and posters waiting with threats, all sorts of things. Anyway, I remember, that's actually not the point of the story. The point is that I was there and I saw lines wrapped around the corner for people to go vote for Robert Francis O'Rourke, right? And so you go and talk to those people and a lot of them are saying, yeah, I've never voted before. I'm from out of state. They won't admit they're voting in different states, but a lot of them are recently registered in the last 30 to 60 days, which is where a lot of the influx of the kind of the fraud happens. And so we know this. When there's independent analyses done of voter registration and you dive into actually the voter rolls, we know this in Michigan, we know this in Texas, that people move, people obviously pass away, and it takes effort to remove them from the voter rolls. So that's one part is the voter registration fraud. The second part is the what I call ballot laundering. And this is something that was made possible thanks to the response to the Chinese coronavirus pandemic with our lockdowns, where they now had an excuse to implement nationwide vote by mail, basically. Now, really good states, they stood up against this. Florida is a perfect example, okay? I'm a resident of Florida. Governor Ron DeSantis should go to every single state across the country that cares about election integrity. And Texas did pretty well. I have to say, you guys did better than most states. There's some things you can clean up in Dallas County, but this state was not a disaster. It wasn't. No, you guys have no idea how bad some of these other states are. In Georgia, I asked how many people got more than 5 ballots sent to your home, and almost half the room raises their hands, right? I mean, they were sending out, and I'll tell you why it happened, because it's actually a really, really good takeaway of how this happened and how we can actually course correct it. And believe it or not, it has to deal with weak Republicans and political correctness, but we'll deal with that in a second. So Ron DeSantis should go around the country and teach states that actually care about voter integrity. Why is it that the state of Florida, that has nearly 1.5 times the population of Georgia, can have all their votes in by 9 o'clock Eastern, and it takes Georgia 8 days to figure it out with inconsistent results? Why? How is that possible? And the reason is leadership. This is why. It's because Ron DeSantis is an actual conservative who loves his country. I think in times like this, it's easy to complain. It's easy to get worried. Let's lift the good people up, right? Let's do a better job of lifting up the governor of Georgia. Not one of those people. Ron DeSantis should be lifted up. So what did he do? If you remember back in 2018, he was running for the governor's race against a fraud and actually a criminal, Andrew Gillum. Andrew Gillum was endorsed by Barack Obama, tons of money. They had not won the Florida's governor mansion since 1996, right near there. It's been almost my entire life, Florida's been Republican. And so they spent tons of money. And you remember that it was then Governor Rick Scott against incumbent Senator Bill Nelson, who was very, very well liked. And so Florida was kind of a test case of where the country was. This was during the Mueller investigation. This was 2 years ago. I know it feels like it was two decades ago, but it was 2 years ago. And you might remember Ron DeSantis, we weren't really sure who was winning. And Broward County refused to put in their election results. And a woman by the name of Brenda Snipes, who is a complete and total fraud, well known in, you know, kind of Florida circles, refused to say how many ballots were left. You remember these famous videos of ballots being put in pickup trucks? It was this unbelievable, it was a black eye on Florida election politics. So Ron DeSantis ends up winning. They do a recount. He wins by like 14,000 votes, which is considered a blowout, right? In Florida, 14,000 votes is, you're really doing amazing if you win by that many votes, because Florida always seems to kind of just be 500, 5,000, 6,000 votes. The first thing Ron DeSantis did when he got into office, he said, Brenda Snipes, you're resigning. You're done. Asked for her resignation. Then Ron DeSantis did the difficult but necessary work, and he picked all the correct fights. And he said, I'm going to sue every single Democrat Secretary of State, every Board of Election Supervisor. I'm going to be called all these awful names, but we're going to purge our voter rolls. And the only way you get a ballot is if you request it. That's it. You must request the ballot. And then if you try to vote in person, you can't vote in person. So I'm naturally skeptical. And Ron DeSantis was talking a really good game on this. And Ron's a friend of mine. And so I'm a resident of Florida. I went to go vote in the Sarasota area early. And as I was checking in to vote, a guy comes in and he says, I want to vote. They say, okay, show us your information. In Florida, they require voter ID to vote early. What a concept. And so the woman checks him in. And they say, well, sir, it looks like you already got an absentee ballot sent to you. Not even submitted. Sent to you. And he said, yeah, I don't know about that. I want to vote. Very suspicious, right? Very dodgy. Well, sir, we can't let you vote here today because we sent you an absentee ballot. I saw this happen in person. And they say, well, I want to vote. And they say, well, you can vote provisionally, but then if we find out that you submitted your ballot, you could go to jail for double voting. A little bit of an argument came and he left. And there I saw right there someone who probably wanted to game the system, checked, balanced, gone. That's how a system is supposed to work. And now Florida, what happens when a system works? When a system works the way it's supposed to, Donald Trump wins by nearly 4 points, not 4,000 votes. Not 40,000 votes. He wins Florida by 430,000 votes. 430,000 votes in Florida. How is that possible? It's simple. It's because Ron DeSantis went in and he cleared out the voter rolls. He said, you're only getting a ballot if you request one. And they hawked the voting precincts and the polling places. Now, contrast that with Georgia. Now, I'm going to be very honest with all of you here. Just outside of all the evidence and all this, just looking geographically, I refuse to believe that you win Florida by 400,000 votes and you lose Georgia and you win North Carolina. That things change. They don't change that dramatically in 2 years, okay? That sort of stuff, it's what we all of a sudden call, there's probably a crime. We should go investigate it. That's what that's called. And so what happened in Georgia? Happened in Georgia is the exact opposite. Is Brian Kemp won in 2018. Now, Brian Kemp's done some things okay with lockdowns and whatever, okay? He's actually handled it better than most. DeSantis has been better than him. However, Kemp has not been bad on that. But Kemp won. And from the moment Kemp won, Stacey Abrams never lost sight of him. She went and raised $40 million of out-of-state money, go hired Perkins Coie and all these ridiculously expensive law firms, came in and started suing and suing and suing. And she had really good arguments. If you actually read the briefs and you read, there were people that, again, they're very emotional stories, but they said that they saw their ballot was never submitted and it was rejected because of signature verification process. Okay, so Roffensperger and Kemp, instead of fighting like DeSantis did and winning in court in Florida, they settled. Now, mind you, they unconstitutionally settled. It's the state legislature that has to change the way votes are done, but they settled. And they said, okay, we'll relax the signature requirements, this variety of stuff that was just a gift to Stacey Abrams. Now, mind you, the thought process for Kemp and Roffensperger is this is a solidly red state. We'll win by 3 points instead of 3.2 points, whatever. We'll make it up in some sort of thing in the future. Now, you pair that with Joe Biden spending tons of money in, you know, Metro Atlanta and the most sophisticated voter fraud operation and ballot laundering operation that we've ever seen.
Now, the other part of this that, again, I only have limited time, so I could literally talk for 2 hours about this, is the Center for Technology and Civic Life, which was a $400 million infusion of cash from the data billionaires and the tech billionaires. And so there was a 501c3 that was doing about $500,000 a year to try and expand voting access, right? It was practically dormant. No one took it seriously. So then somebody orchestrated this. Who this somebody is, we can only guess. So all of a sudden, Mark Zuckerberg makes an announcement and he says, I'm going to put $350 million into this 501c3 that only does a $500,000 budget. So they go from a budget of $500,000 to $350 million. Now, if you think they're doing that without some sort of assurance that there's going to be something happening in the direction of their worldview, I mean, give me a break. That is an astronomical amount of money to just all of a sudden throw into a C3 that has no proven track record. Now, what did they do with that money? What they did is actually unconstitutional. And this is going to take a long time to unravel this particular complaint, but there's some really good people that are litigating, Phil Klein being one of them, former Attorney General of Kansas, which is that you cannot use private money to supplement the vote counting process. You can't do that. You can't go take 501c3 charitable money and go hire election judges and go hire vote counters or vote tabulators. That's precisely what they did. It's unconstitutional in every single state, and they did it under the guise of the pandemic. But the real coup of what they did is they installed these ballot boxes in every major city across the country. I don't know if Dallas had them or not, but they had them in Philadelphia. They had them in Pittsburgh. They definitely had them in Atlanta. Now, what's the significance of this? Anonymized vote drop places where all of a sudden, if your job is to go collect ballots for somebody, wearing a mask, of course, you can drop off hundreds, if not thousands of ballots and they get washed. Think of it as if you're trying to launder money. And this is what I always laugh at these people. They say, there's no evidence at all. There's no voter fraud. I say, wait a second. People cheat on their taxes. People cheat on fantasy football. People cheat on video games. People cheat on Monopoly. People cheat on stupid, silly things. And you're trying to tell me when the $4 trillion a year government that controls the greatest army ever in the history of the world to be able to conduct the future of America, people all of a sudden act beautifully, ethically, and all the criminals say, I'm not going to get involved in this? Like, we're supposed to believe that? We're supposed to believe when the ultimate prize is up for grabs that all of a sudden people say, you know what? I'm actually not going to do it. We have criminals in every aspect of society. Now, voter fraud, like money laundering, you have to look into it. If we just took a drive throughout North Dallas to every laundromat, you wouldn't see the money laundering happening until you go look for the money laundering. Money laundering is a multi-billion dollar a month, and more than that. It's probably multi-trillion dollar a year industry if you count all the drug trade and the cartel. How do you do it? You clean the money. Same way you clean the ballots. So you have millions of ballots being sent out to every single person. And it wouldn't actually take this many people to go do this. It would take probably 50 or 60 hardened criminals that know what they're doing to go scoop up ballots in college districts, apartment buildings, and the kicker, and we can prove this, senior living centers. This is the one we can prove. And this is the one that if we had a Department of Justice, which unfortunately we don't, we're basically operating without our right flank here, this is where all my focus would be. Now, we have evidence, not just in the mathematical, we'll get into that in a second, but we have evidence of this woman by the name of Susie runs a developmentally disabled center in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. She was not allowed to access any of her patients the last 30 days before the election because of a Chinese coronavirus outbreak in her area, but she communicates to them via Zoom. These are developmentally disabled elderly people. So on Zoom, she started to talk to her people that she assists, developmentally disabled, and 20 of them, she said, everyone that she's responsible for said that somebody came in and forced them to go vote for Joe Biden. Now, either she's making this up and she's schizophrenic, or maybe there's something that's worthy of an investigation from the Department of Justice at that living center in Milwaukee. She came out, said it on local radio, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. It's finally getting national traction. Now, that would explain exactly the missing gap that we see in Pennsylvania. Now, this is a process. I did not come up with this term. I don't love this term. It's just a term that really, you'll never forget it. It's called granny farming. Okay. The New York Times came up with this. Okay. I don't like the term, but you remember it. Okay. It has impact, which the New York Times came up with it in 2012, which is, again, if go read the New York Times diagnosis when they were afraid that Republicans were using vote by mail to win elections. Remember, Republicans used to dominate vote by mail. And Democrats were worried about this. So in 2012, the New York Times wrote a 3,000-word piece of how to spot voter fraud, how to prevent against it, and the investigations that need to happen into it. This is back in 2012. until they realized they could use racial identity politics to their advantage. So all of a sudden, you can't even talk about this stuff. Like, okay, you can't talk about it because you're afraid of being called the awful R word. Okay, so in Pennsylvania, there was a sudden, now just think about this logically, 1,774% increase for new voter registrations for 90-plus-year-olds in the midst of a pandemic. This is what we're supposed, if you believe that Biden won, you must accept everything I'm telling you wholeheartedly, no questions asked. I mean, this is a religion. You must, I mean, it is not just a religion, it's a mythology is what it is. If you believe this, they say, yeah, okay. So by the way, you dive into it, 38% of them registered to vote online. 90-plus-year-olds in the midst of a pandemic. They took out their iPads and they all of a sudden decided to go register to vote. For the first time, many of these people have never voted before. What's a more logical belief is exactly what we know happened, is that well-incentivized criminal thugs did the unspeakable. They went after the greatest generation who were isolated, afraid, and at risk, fraudulently registered them to vote and intercepted their ballots when they arrived and submitted them on their behalf. That's probably what happened. And that would explain why all of a sudden we saw these spikes that were so just unusual in precincts that had shared living senators for people over the age of 90. That would explain that. And by the way, it's in defiance to the national trend. What's so amazing, if you believe the Biden mythology, we're supposed to believe that Republicans won 27 out of 27 House districts across the country that were competitive. The Economist, The Nation, Larry Sabato, and that Nate Silver, who's a total fool. He should be excommunicated from all decent society. This guy, he's a robber baron. He really is. And anyone who dares call out this guy, he's a professional pollster. He said that Nancy Pelosi was going to get 250 House seats. Okay? She'll be lucky if she gets 222. It'll probably be 221. So he was only off by 38, right? Only. What a wonderful margin to be able to operate from. But it goes from, you're thinking, 244 to 221. Republicans flips three state legislatures, one governor's mansion, and did not lose a state legislature across the country, including in this wonderful state, which you guys deserve great credit for. Tons of out-of-state money poured into this state. In order to believe the Biden mythology, you're supposed to believe the following, that blacks and Hispanics grew in support for Donald Trump, except for three counties. That blacks and Hispanics in three counties that mattered in the swing states that determined the future of our republic, those blacks and Hispanics were like, we hate him more. But the blacks and Hispanics in the Rio Grande Valley or Miami-Dade County or in Chicago, D.C., Boston, L.A., Seattle, Portland, those blacks and Hispanics were like, we actually like him more. If you believe the Biden mythology, you're supposed to believe that all of a sudden at an arbitrary county line, just a county line, there's no trend whatsoever to usual voting trends. For example, Fulton County, Georgia. All of a sudden, the Fulton County line, you can bet dime on a dollar that Biden is going to overperform Hillary Clinton by 8 points. The other side of the line, you go to Fayette County, you go to any of these other counties, Trump will overperform what he did in 2016, like that, like clockwork. Take Dane County, Wisconsin. Anyone from Wisconsin? Anyone? Okay, one person. Great. So, oh, it's a couple people. So I'm from Northern Illinois. I know Dane County really well. Dane County is where the University of Wisconsin-Madison is. University of Wisconsin-Madison is one of the most liberal schools in the entire Midwest. When Barack Obama visited, they had hundreds of thousands of people show up. No joke. It was legitimate. It was authentic. Do you remember Obama in 08? It was real. It was kinetic. You could feel it. You could touch it. It was the most overwhelming political movement, I think, even more so at times than Trump in certain areas across the country. Bumper stickers, yard signs, people that were wearing just shirts for the fun of it. It was the closest mixture of unified sports support, Hollywood, and cultural kind of pseudo-revolution that I think I will ever come to in my life. And I think we all agree with that. But we're supposed to believe that despite all of that, that factoring even for population growth, Joe Biden did 7% better in Dane County, Wisconsin than Barack Obama did in 2008, with the campus mostly closed. And if you dare ask a question, you're a threat to democracy. Sit down and shut up. And I know what a lot of you are thinking. Then why hasn't something happened about it? Why hasn't something happened? And here's the problem, is that this entire thing is not an accident. Up until people like Jackie, who've been doing unbelievable work, we have just been players in their game. There's a reason why he didn't campaign. There's a reason why they had this whole thing figured out, okay? From the ballot collection, the voter registration, the vote by mail, we were all just playing as if this was a persuasion election, when in reality, this was really more kind of who can mechanize politics better. You know, we talk about the Chicago machine. We talk about machine politics. They built a machine, legitimately and real. And so here's the problem. Judges don't want to get involved in this stuff, and they're not going to get involved in it. Judges are not political by nature. They don't like it. They didn't like it in 2000 when they were put in that situation with Bush versus Gore. And as you can see with the Supreme Court, they want nothing to do with it. I think that what your attorney general here did and many other states was heroic, and they deserve great credit for that. They really do. It was a terrific thing, because not enough kind of remedies or measures were presenting itself. Too many state legislatures have sat idly by and allowed this to happen. Establishment Republicans in Arizona, Georgia, and Pennsylvania have been terrible. Republican Raffensperger in Georgia is defending a broken system. And the more lawsuits, the more investigations, it'll be proven that he was defending something he knew that was corrupt and broken to save his reputation. That's what he's been doing in Georgia. But the problem is this, is that as soon as a Secretary of State sets up certain rules and guidelines and they determine a quote-unquote winner, the chances of reverse engineering that in the time allotted is increasingly difficult. We knew it was difficult. That's why these kind of arbitrary fights to go cleanse the voter rolls, to like, it actually matters more at times than even persuading the population. To give you an idea, in Georgia, if we would have just had anywhere close to similar signature verification, the Armistead Project, Phil Klein and other people, and Jackie would know these numbers better than I would, will say that Trump wins Georgia by 70, 80,000 votes, anywhere between that. Might have been 50,000, right around there, if we just would have had the signature verification we had in 2018, let alone 2016. And so a lot of you are saying, well, what's the remedy? What's the remedy? Well, look, there's one final step that has to be taken. The Electoral College obviously met today, but that's not the final step. And the final step is exactly what happened in 1876. And again, this is such a long shot. The chance of this happening is next to nothing. But it still is. It's kind of one of those that you're telling me there's a chance. Like, there's, it's very small. And what happened in 1876 was Rutherford B. Hayes, running as a Republican, was up against Samuel Tilden, who was the governor of New York. This was Reconstruction America. If you think America's divided now, just go back in a time machine and go read your 1876 history. Republicans controlled the Senate, but the chambers were mixed. I think Republicans controlled the Senate. That's right. Republicans controlled the Senate. Democrats controlled the House of Representatives. Now, what's the significance of that? This election was hotly contested. Fraud allegations everywhere you could see. And Rutherford B. Hayes had a singular electoral vote, one electoral vote margin. So the Electoral College meets, but what's the final step that needs to happen? Is the House and the Senate need to certify the results. That's the final step. Now, this is generally just a procedural step. Not since really 1876 have we seen this come up, but what happened in 1876, and it was actually a brutal thing that ended up happening. It's actually pretty much indefensible. But what ended up happening is the Democrats wielded their power for evil, is what ended up happening. Is the Democrats said, okay, we're not going to certify this, but we will put Rutherford B. Hayes as president if you stop all Reconstruction in the South. And it was unspeakably evil, right? So they used their political power by saying, we're going back to Jim Crow laws, poll taxes, segregation, you know, the Democrats going back to their roots, and which they haven't changed. And they said this, and unfortunately, the great bargain of 1876 was brokered. What's the point of the story? Is that the United States Senate, controlled by Republicans, could end up putting up a fight. Now, the chances of getting Collins, Murkowski, and Romney right there and McConnell of doing that on January 6th, I think we all know what we're dealing with. However, I think that we need to find a singular so all it takes is this. The way it works, without getting too kind of intricate and technical, is that if one House member, Mo Brooks is going to do it, he said he will, and one member of the Senate objects, it just takes one object, then it goes to a two-hour debate, and then you have a roll call vote. They don't want a roll call vote, okay? They want a voice vote. They don't actually want to go on the record about this. And this is where it actually matters. We have to force a roll call vote. I bet Rand Paul, maybe a senator from Texas, might be able to have an objection. Doug, you know some people, make some calls. And Then it will go to a roll call vote. I want to see every Republican that puts their name behind the certification of this election. If you believe this was valid and this was fine and you think it should continue, by the way, it's not like you're voting. We're not asking people to vote for Biden. It's not about that. It's, are you putting your blessing as a United States senator as the final step of approval, saying that this election was not one that deserves at least some a deeper form of questioning? That's basically the last step. The Supreme Court is basically signaled in motion based on this interstate lawsuit we saw with Texas. Supreme Court doesn't want anything to do with this. The chance of the Supreme Court taking this up is they're going to keep on kicking this down. That's what they told us. Okay, and you could be disappointed, you can be mad about it. That's the state of it. The other circuit court stuff, I'm going to just tell you guys, no judge is going to overturn this at this point. Okay, it's just not going to happen. Now, long term, through discovery and civil suits and all that, we can end up discovering a lot. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't be persistent, we shouldn't be focused on all of it. But the last step is the United States Senate. So we can kind of see what happens there. And I would be very, very interested to see where a lot of these Republicans that asked for our support, asked for our help, all of a sudden will be when we put them, say, okay, are you going to certify this election? And by the way, I am just skimming the beginning of the surface of exactly what I could talk. I could do, there's so many, there's the other part of voter fraud that I could talk about, which is just as important, is who actually counts the votes and how they count the votes. And as Jackie showed us in the video, is all of a sudden they have this box of ballots that they find underneath the table in the middle of the night when all the other election judges go home. It goes on and on and on with all of this and all these very convenient vote dumps that happen in the middle of the night. But unfortunately, this is the broader picture, is that when we as Republicans and conservatives were doing our best to actually focus on politics, they were focused on process and personnel. And this is the bigger takeaway, is that politics matters a lot less than the personnel and the process. And Democrats being more likely to be lawyers than Republicans, it's just true. The Democrats are way more in the legal world than Republicans are. They have a love affair with the process. And most importantly, how they can make the process work for them. The vote tabulation, the voter registration, all these different sorts of things. In addition to also the personnel. Who is actually making these decisions? They've gotten heavily involved in that. And that's why Soros put in hundreds of millions of dollars the last couple decades to the Secretary of States, to the Attorney Generals, to all these different levels of government to try and not have investigations actually occur. And so I know a lot of you guys are apprehensive. And so here's the thing that we kind of have to say out loud, is that Joe Biden might become president of the United States. I said might. I didn't say he will. I'm not going to do that thing where it's going to happen assuredly or definitively. And so once you get your shell shock over, then let's talk about what that actually means. What that actually means is that any sort of hope, dream that you have that we're going to return to how things used to be, we're going to enter the most brutal collision course in American history, that very well, it's post-Civil War, I could say. They're not going to stop. They will never stop. These people want full and complete institutional control, and they want to make America in their image. They've told us what that looks like. And that goes from the indoctrination of your children to the closure of your churches to the mandatory vaccinations to the opening of your borders. That's just the beginning for them. And so then what do we actually do about that if that ends up happening? Well, here's the good news, is that I actually think the people are with us. I think that this is the most artificial power grab in American history, and we should never stop saying that. We have to prove it. We have to say it. We have to repeat it. The people are actually with us. Most importantly, we made record gains with blacks and Hispanics, unless they live in certain counties that matter. Rio Grande Valley, what happened here in Texas in the Rio Grande Valley is a fire alarm for Democrats. You guys do that again, you're going to run this state for the next 100 years. It's that simple. What happened in the Rio Grande Valley is a sign of hope in this state. And why did it happen? It happened because we actually didn't listen to the GOP consultant class that told you what to do in this state, like the Bush people in this state. I know that's a heresy to say in this neighborhood. I don't care. So anyway, yeah. Oh, well, there you go. They say this. They say, get weak on immigration. Don't talk about social issues. Talk about amnesty and all the Hispanics will love you. When in reality, the opposite is true. If you talk about strong immigration, fairness, be unapologetically pro-life, talk about religious values, entrepreneurship, and then take a stance against the lockdowns, Hispanics, very much small business owners, All of a sudden, you're going to win in historic fashion. And the Democrats are puzzled, and they say, what on earth is all this? And they're realizing that Hispanics don't want the hyper-racialization of American politics either. Hispanics don't want, all of a sudden, all these different type of corporate-funded social movements where your judge of how good of a person you are is whether or not you have a BLM sign outside of your 19,000-square-foot home in Highland Park, Texas. Like, we got it. You're a wonderfully good person. Like, thank you for, I wish I could be as good of a person as you are. It's true. And actually, normal people, which the Hispanics in this country have, they are more likely to work with their hands, oil and gas. So you say you're going to abolish oil and gas, good luck winning the Rio Grande Valley. They're more likely to work in what I call the muscular economy, not the Zoom and Skype economy. Hispanics and blacks are more likely to be the ones that are wearing the masks to deliver you your packages while you go complain and say, we need to go lock down the country for 9 months. Many Hispanics in the Rio Grande Valley can't survive a lockdown another 30 days, let alone another 30 months. And so all of a sudden, this started to kind of transform itself into the exact opposite than what the GOP consultant class would tell you how to win Hispanics and blacks over in this state. That should be a lesson for the rest of the country. And you guys should be proud of that, because this state was on the chopping block. And despite, there is one troubling trend here, but it's actually not that troubling, and I'll tell you that in a sec. Despite all of that, Texas stayed red. You did not lose the state house. You guys won congressional seats that you did not think you were going to win, and you won some even more convincingly. Now, what is the one troubling trend here in Texas? The one trend of where something all of a sudden isn't going the way you thought it would go. It's upper middle class whites that live in this neighborhood have decided to engage in the politics of self-loathing. And that's what, and by the way, go do it. This is what the Democrat Party is about to become. And this is the opportunity for Republicans. We're going to go represent the muscular class. You go represent the ruling class and the people that are much more interested in what pronoun you call them and whether or not you have all the correct he, she, is, her, whatever, all that nonsense I have to deal with when I go on college campuses. Here's the point, is that this area here, and you guys know this, has become a pseudo Beverly Hills. And it's becoming that way culturally, politically, and all that other. It is incredibly unpopular with normal people. No, seriously. It is to engage in the type of nonsense that is now seeping into your communities here will actually be the death of the Democrat Party. They will become the ambassadors of the 1% and the representatives of the permanently government addicted, and we will win 90% of the rest of the country. That's the future of politics if we play our cards right. If we get right, I see Tommy here, on education with school choice, we do not abandon. By the way, the not so secret secret is that most of the country actually believes in strong family values. I know this is a really crazy thing to believe, but this kind of social metropolitanism that is now seeping into the upper middle class of our country where they're like, I want to be pro-choice and fiscally conservative. I'm like, that's actually not the way you win over value voters in the Rio Grande Valley. That's how you go win over your cocktail party crowd, because that's all you hang out with. But actually, our generation is the most pro-life generation in American history. Despite what, you know, well, my daughter who goes to NYU says all of her friends are liberal. Precisely. That's not the country. That is a very small microcosm of a type of living that they want to implement for the rest of the country. So what do we actually do? I could talk politically and unpack all this. Politically is this, is that the generic thing you're going to hear a lot of people is fight, fight, fight. But what does that actually mean? There is this obsession that we have, and all of us indulge in it. We got to cut it off immediately in almost building people up just to watch them fall. We do this all the time. And this is what internet culture has done. And it's awful. It's terrible. Basically, there's somebody that we get behind. We like seeing it. And then something unfortunate happens and we kind of all celebrate the demise. And we as conservatives have to understand that now the left, they want to take us all out. They want to take out our organizations, our institutions, our leaders, our spokespeople, our radio hosts, our TV show hosts. They get personal. They'll follow you. It's going to get nasty. So let's start to think, how can I all of a sudden write on a piece of paper the 5 or 6 good guys, people, not institutions, human beings, people like Candace Owens, people like James O'Keefe, people that you can actually talk to, that you can speak to, and you say, I'm going to pray for them, I'm going to support them, I'm going to lift them up. Because I'm going to tell you right now, this fight is all of a sudden it's going to be like Gideon's army in the Bible. People are going to flee like you can never believe. Because this fight, that this collision course that we're coming for is not going to be something that anyone here in this room has lived through. It's not. It will be, I pray it remains nonviolent, a nonviolent metaphorical civil war in this country. Rush Limbaugh was exactly right last week, and no one wants to talk about it. What Rush Limbaugh said is, how can you have a country where you have people that don't agree on anything? What do we have in common with the people from San Francisco who are now moving here to Highland Park? Nothing. We have a unified currency. That's it. We don't have culture. We don't have language. You don't have a shared history. Newsflash, you don't have a country. You don't. And the problem is that they have a theological obsession with actually destroying us. It's not enough that we think differently and that bothers them. It bothers them that we think at all. It bothers them that we dare have an opinion, that we speak into existence. The most intolerant people on the planet are the people that drive their Priuses around with their tolerance bumper stickers. They're the first one to go around that say that white silence is violence and there's you're spreading hate speech and I need to kick you off social media because of all that. And so, yeah, it's going to become a brutal battle. It is. If Joe Biden gets sworn in. Anyone who tries to tell you about how nice it's going to be and, you know, our best days are ahead. Our best days might be ahead, by the way. But we're about to enter into some serious fighting times. And it's not for everyone. I'm built for this. We're built for this at Turning Point. We are. We've been fighting these people for years on college campuses. All of a sudden, now we live on a massive college campus, so you get to go see what I have to deal with. You get to all of a sudden, when you go to Starbucks, you get to see the same tyrant that I have to deal with enforce the stupid mask policy if it's not on correctly. Welcome to the college campusization of America is what's happening. You get the pronouns wrong and the right signs. What happened on UT Austin is now happening everywhere. So people are like, I don't recognize this country. You're right. You shouldn't. Because they have conquered without ever firing a shot most of the American culture. So how do we actually win? Well, we win in a couple different ways. We have to admit that we're in a battle and a struggle. I think you all get that, right? You support the good guys, the people, the human beings to rise up against it. You have to be honest about how this is going to be long and drawn out. But here's the good news, and here's the best news of all, is that their positions that they are taking are so unbelievably radical and unpopular that if we metaphorically hold the line, they will not be in political power for long. They won't. And we saw that. We saw that on a local state level that they were not able to do it. Now, a lot of this has to now get into the mechanical fights of how we tabulate votes and all this. But even deeper on a cultural sense, here's the other thing that I encourage all of you to do. Think way bigger than you're thinking right now. My biggest complaint of the conservative movement is we think way too small. Way too small. You know how the left thinks and stuff like this? If they had, you know, the communist women of Park City or whatever it is, right? The social justice warrior thing, whatever they do around here, right? Like, you know, please take my money because somebody called me a racist, whatever they do around here, right? So, you know what they talk about? They talk about massive moonshot stuff. They're like, we're going to end racism. Like, that's a pretty ambitious goal. Like, that's like the biggest goal. It's basically like sending, we are going to end sin is what it's like at sin. That's what they're saying. You think about it. Racism is a sin. It's an awful sin. But that's how big they think. Everything down there kind of seems achievable, right? If you come from the opening shot of we are going to end hatred of human beings one to the other, and the next thing is like we're going to take over every single university, you're like, yeah, I think I can do that. We as conservatives don't think big enough. We don't. And so what does that actually mean? Well, we say at Turning Point every single day, we want our kids to love America again. It's that simple. I want 7 and 8 year olds to be more fired up about their country than their 30 year old parents. I want 30 year old parents to have to go to their 7 and 8 year olds and saying, I know Thomas Jefferson was amazing. I got it. Now please go eat your dinner. I want young people to be so on fire for their country that the older generations have to keep them in check. That's what I want. How do you get there? Well, we have to be honest about what the problem actually is. Again, I know I'm over time, so I apologize, but one of the reasons we did this, and this will be the kind of the final segment of what I'm talking about, is that we got the year 1989 and 1991, we screwed it up terribly. I was born in 93. What happened in 1989 and 1991 was heroic, it was wonderful, but we handled it so unbelievably incorrect. We're now living through the consequences of it. What happened in 89 and 91? 89, the Berlin Wall fell. 91, the dissolution of the Soviet Union. We won. We didn't act like winners. We didn't. You know what H.W. Bush said to his aides when the Berlin Wall fell? They said, sir, do you want to give a speech? He said, I don't want to rub it in. That's what he said. What an unbelievably dreadful, generationally impactful mistake. Throughout the 60s, 70s, and 80s, we had children hiding underneath desks in school against nuclear death. We had entire civilizations that very well could have been toppled. We won the war because of ideology. We had better ideas. It's that simple. We rose up, got Ronald Reagan, industrial might, all these sorts of things. Nikita Khrushchev in 1961, when he sent a man to space, you know what Nikita Khrushchev said? He said, when our astronaut went to space, he looked around to find God and he found him nowhere. Taunting us of our belief in God and not a belief in just the Soviet Union as the top power. They were taunting us theologically, religiously, spiritually, politically, and we won. We won. It's the greatest military victory post-World War II. And it was different because we won it in a different way. We won it because we unified in the 1980s. We believed in the American experiment. We taught our history. We rose up, had a wonderful leader. And what did his vice president and predecessor did? Nothing. So what ended up happening? We just kind of took the 1990s off is what we did. We kind of had like a moderate Democrat, corrupt, philandering president. And we just didn't kind of care and kind of raise, you know, that's when I grew up. And what did they do? You think the Soviet communists stopped? They took over every single one of the colleges you send your kids to. They now write all the textbooks. They took over our mega corporations. And after the dissolution of the Soviet Union, while we weren't even like doing a victory lap, H.W. Bush should have traveled Europe to every single country with Ronald Reagan and given a speech in Hungary and in Bulgaria and in Latvia and Estonia and Lithuania and told them all, you are now free because of us. And it would have been a generational, it would have been a cornerstone speech for the entire country. Instead, you just kind of allowed it to happen. He gave a couple speeches here and there, but it wasn't the triumphant, we won for a specific reason. Now, what's the consequence of that? The consequence is what we're living through right now. We're living through all of the Soviets that used to be concentrated in either Rhodesia, Zimbabwe, Cuba, all this. They all came here and they plotted and they thought really big. Really big. And they found the financing to do it. George Soros, Tom Steyer. And they realized and they learned along the way, they tried the economic thing. This is what no one understands. You remember Occupy Wall Street? It was an unbelievable failure. They tried to create a class war in this country and they failed. And then they went back and they said, what is the one thing that we can talk about that can create the conflict we need to get us power? Race. Race and gender. Class wars don't work in America. Why? Because markets work so well that people just get richer each year. They're like, yeah, I get this whole hate the rich thing, but I actually live a pretty comfortable life and I'm thankful. But all of a sudden, when you start talking about race and gender, there's paralysis because we never taught our children the correct race and gender history of our country. And the opposite. They go to university, they go to elementary school, and they learn nothing except that we're racist, bigoted, homophobic, colonialist, awful. By the time you're 14 or 15, it's a question of how do we revolutionize this awful place around us? And Khrushchev bragged about this in 1959. He says, you guys don't understand that your children and your grandchildren will be living in communism and we're going to feed it to you bit by bit. The one piece that they missed, though, was how they were going to do it. So what are the institutions that do this? Happy to go at length about this. Colleges are basically ruining America. It's that simple. If we don't cut the college population in half in the next decade, we won't have a country. I know this is not exactly popular to talk about in Highland Park. When I talk about this in Odessa, everyone's cheering, they're screaming, they're loving it. Everyone's kind of like, what are you talking about here? Look, I'm going to be as blunt as I possibly can. I'm probably talking too fast anyway, but here. We have a generation of young people that are borrowing money they don't have to study things that don't matter, to find jobs that don't exist. Your child does not need to go to college to succeed. Now, if they want to become a doctor, a lawyer, an engineer, terrific. College should not be a place for ideological discovery. Really bad place to do that. College has become the number one reason why my generation is financially in a worse position than the generation before it. They got a meaningless piece of paper and $65,000 in debt and tons of bad ideas weaponized for revolution. And then they get stuck in urban cities. They don't marry. They have all these secular humanist ideas where they learn evangelistically that there is no God, and yet we continue to repeat these mistakes. So the purpose of higher education should be about career development, not necessarily ideological exploration. And so thinking big, really big, would be, why do we need these massive, inflated, corrupt, left-wing institutions anymore? Like, what are we doing? Why are we giving our donations to these schools? Why are our Republican governors not demanding answers from A&M or UT Austin? And I could go chapter and verse of stuff that would just make every single person here upset. Now, I know a lot of you say, well, Charlie, what are they supposed to do then? I could tell you, we import immigrants to go do the jobs they don't want to do, to go be computer engineers, to go get an 18-month degree in computer coding, or we have a nationwide shortage with plumbers, HVAC, welders, carpenters, people that serve and work with their hands. But here's the honest truth, and I'm just going to be as blunt as I can. In this neighborhood, that's not considered to be a nice profession. It's not. In Highland Park, your kid goes to UT Austin to go work in the information economy. And it's more socially acceptable for the kid to go to UT Austin and go work in the information economy and maybe be like pseudo-employed than to go get a plumbing degree and then go earn $80,000 a year. But no one actually wants to go tell their neighbor, yeah, XYZ is a plumber. That's a big part of the problem, is the social status of what your kids actually do. And no one wants to talk about it. And so it's time to think big and fight. This is going to be, I'm in some ways, I'm excited. I'm Scottish. I love fighting. It's in my blood. We've been doing it for many hundreds of years and we're really good at it. And so I got some skulls over there. It's very good. So, look, there's so many different things I could cover here. I'll close with this, which is a lot of people are going to be asking, what can I materially do? Act as if what you do makes the difference that you wish other people would make. And so everything that you do in this political and cultural fight absolutely matters. Everything that you do. And this is what excites me more than anything else. This is why I think in the end we will win, is that there's a renaissance of learning the likes of which I've never seen before. My podcasts, our radios, the long episodes we do, people that want to all of a sudden say, hold on a second. What is this critical race theory that my kids are learning? And moms especially are now becoming the guardians of our culture. No offense to the dads or the husbands. They're actually way less informed than the moms across the country. No, seriously. It's the moms and the women that are all of a sudden coming with alert. They're saying, I'm not all of a sudden going to say that my kid needs to be mandatorily vaccinated to go attend a school. Like, that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. If you run out of things to do, go learn. Wisdom will give you the instruction of where to go in these times. Where do you find wisdom? Of course, in Proverbs, the Bible, the great thinkers that built our entire society. And then you take that knowledge into action. Once you put that knowledge into action, that's exactly how we're going to win. They're entering a moment, the left and the Democrats, where they inevitably, if Joe Biden becomes president, they are going to enter into a Democrat civil war, the likes of which they are not prepared for. The corporate Democrats are going to fight the radical Democrats. I believe we are going to be unbelievably united around this. And there'll be a lot of stuff that we're not going to like to see. When they close the embassy in Jerusalem, when they redo the Iran deal, all that stuff, it's going to be tough. What do? You learn. You dive deeper, and then that will give you the knowledge what to do. And then you act. You knock on the doors, you become a precinct committee person and all of that. And so that's what we're doing every single day at Turning Point USA and Turning Point Action. And I guess my time is up. You guys are awesome. Thank you. Okay.